Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 31st, 2008. I'm Robert Tretterick. This week, a bacterium that helps protect insects from deadly viruses, 30 years of expanded academic freedom in China, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
You might not expect a bacterial infection to stave off an infection from a deadly virus, but in a brevium in this week's Science, Karen Johnson and colleagues report that when flies were infected with deadly viruses, the flies that also had an infection of Wolbachia bacterium lived significantly longer than those without the bacterial infection. The research may help scientists reduce the spread of insect-transmitted diseases in people. I spoke with Johnson from her office at the University of Queensland in Australia.
We have found an interaction between a bacteria and a virus, which was really unexpected, in that the bacteria actually protects flies from virus infection, which is the opposite of what you'd expect. Normally you'd expect for one microbial infection to cause you to be more susceptible to a second infection. So in this case, what we've found is that if flies are infected with a bacteria, then they're less susceptible to mortality caused by viral infection.
What is this bacteria and where is it typically found?
It's called Wolbachia, and it's a bacterium which is found in about 20% of insect species, although there are some estimates which suggest that it could be as high as 66% of insect species. It's also found in some crustaceans and some filarial nematodes, mites and spiders.
And this is a parasitic bacterium?
It's a symbiotic bacteria in most cases. In some cases, it's what's called a mutualist, which means that it provides things to the host and the host provides things to it. In some cases, it can have some pathology in that it causes things like feminization or skewing of the population as to whether how many males and females you get within a population.
And presumably one of the benefits to this fly is that it also protects it from viruses. What kind of viruses?
So the viruses that we've looked at so far are viruses which naturally infect Drosophila. The main one we worked with was called Drosophila C virus. And it's a virus which belongs to the sort of large group of the coronaviruses, so things like poliovirus, although this group of viruses is quite distinct from those. They're called dicistroviruses.
And so by infecting these flies with this bacteria, you were able to show that by later infecting them with a virus, they lived longer. Is that it?
Yes, so they live about twice as long, which is quite a dramatic effect in terms of looking at mortality types of assays. It's sort of the most dramatic effect that we've found, and we've been looking at lots of different fly lines looking for genetic basis of difference to response of flies to virus infection. So it's quite a dramatic effect. And then also on top of that, we've been able to show that the amount of virus which is accumulating in those flies is very much delayed. So there's some effect that the bacteria is having which is causing the virus to replicate to a lower extent or at a lower rate.
Do you and your team know what's behind that mechanism that's preventing the virus from replicating as fast?
As yet, we do not know what is the mechanism behind that is, and we're currently working towards trying to work that out at the moment.
When that does become clear, or in the meantime, how might this research be applied?
I guess the sort of application of the research is that many insects vector viruses which infect both humans, other animals, and also plants. And so if we can understand what's happening in the insect vector and control the spread of disease by controlling the amount of virus which is spread by insects, then we may be able to control many different diseases which cause a lot of pathology and problems in both agricultural species, humans, and other animals.
So might there be implications for using this same kind of antiviral mechanism with people directly, not through insect as vectors, but by using the mechanism that the bacteria use to go after viruses within people?
I think there's certainly potential that that may be the case. It's a long off aim, and until we understand the mechanism, we won't know. But certainly by understanding what the immune responses are in insects and how insects combat virus infection and perhaps in combination with the bacterium in this case, then that may lead us to understand better how innate immunity works in humans.
Karen Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Johnson is senior author of a paper on Wolbachia and virus protection in insects. Read the paper in this week's Science. It's been 30 years since Chinese leaders reopened their country to the outside world, and since then, China's science, like its economy, has grown immensely. For example, China is now second only to the United States in the number of publications in international journals. But as contributing correspondent Hao Seng reports in this week's Science, there are still many systemic problems in Chinese science, some of which still curb academic freedom. I spoke with Science's Asia News editor, Richard Stone, about it.
The article is about some of the major challenges in China in the scientific community, about how scientists there are struggling with demands that are placed on them to crank out papers, to really churn out research which drives them toward pursuing rather mundane projects. I think it's mostly tied to the way researchers are reviewed in China. Many institutes do review scientific staff based on how many papers they've churned out and where they've published. So there is a realization that the Chinese leaders have to get away from that.
Why is the story coming up now?
Well, we're doing it now because this is the 30th anniversary of major reforms and opening up initiated under Deng Xiaoping, the top leader in China after Mao Zedong. And it was really a breath of clean air for Chinese scientists. They had a major science and technology conference in the spring of 1978 that many scientists regard as a turning point for Chinese science.
What are still some of the problems since that time, since 1978, that don't seem to be going away in terms of academic freedom in China?
Well, I think that part of the problem is just the way that researchers feel constrained in challenging older scientists, in speaking up about necessary changes. And I think that it's a problem which has only been growing recently.
Has technology made any sort of impact, especially the internet and the freedoms that it allows?
Well, that's one promising area for Chinese science, isn't that bulletin boards and blogs are relatively unfettered. So people freely speak their mind. And for Chinese scientists, there's a sense that they have the freedom to discuss problems in the Chinese research community that they cannot talk about in other kinds of print media, the usual forums, which are much more restrictive.
In these blogs, though, the scientists are posting anonymously, or are they using their real names? Wouldn't that get them into trouble?
There is a very popular forum called ScienceNet where bloggers do use their real names, and they do not feel that they have to mince words. So it's a huge change in that being able to express themselves freely in this kind of forum. I think it came as a surprise when this kind of discussion first took place, I'd say a couple of years ago. But now, you know, researchers do take it as a fundamental freedom. There are also other blogs in where people don't use their real names, and there's a lot of flaming which goes on there. But I think that that's not taken as seriously as the few forums like ScienceNet, where researchers really do stand by their viewpoints.
How does the government feel about this?
Well, there's a sense among the Chinese scientific community that the top leaders in China are encouraging this because they get a true picture of what scientists think and feel. And that's not the kind of picture which they may be receiving from science policy officials. So that's why Chinese scientists assume that their free and unfettered discussion on the internet has so far been accepted by the government.
What would be their motivation for wanting to get an accurate picture of what's really happening in science and technology in China?
Well, as the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao told Bruce Alberts in the interview we published in the October 17th issue, his firm belief is that science and technology is crucial to the growth of China. And in fact, he said very clearly, one of his statements was that only science will save China. So from their viewpoint, it's essential that the Chinese scientific community grows in a way which allows it to keep pace or catch up with Western researchers.
Rich Stone, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Richard Stone is Science's Asia News editor, talking there about Hao Xing's article on academic freedom in China. You can read her article in this week's Science. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about selectively erasing memories, how purple tomatoes can be used to fight cancer, and finally, how Viagra might provide hope for patients with muscular dystrophy.
Well, let's start with selectively erasing memories. I imagine this was first done in an animal model.
Well, first and only. This research so far has only been carried out in mice, but it's preliminarily at least very exciting. And this gets to the idea of, can scientists find a way to not just erase somebody's memory, but just erase certain parts of the memory? And in this study, the researchers focused on an enzyme called alpha-CAMK2. And maybe we'll just refer to it as the enzyme from now on. But basically, this enzyme belongs to a family of enzymes that have an important role in neural signaling, so all the signals that happen in our brain. And the researchers said, well, maybe this is a good target for forming memories, and let's see what happens if we mess with this enzyme in mice. And they designed mice that overexpressed this enzyme, so that these mice produced a lot of this enzyme in their brain. And if they gave the mice a drug, the levels of this enzyme would return to normal. And what they did is they gave mice the drug, so they had normal levels of this enzyme, and they trained the mice to be afraid of two things. When they played a certain tone, the mice got zapped after they heard this tone. And when they placed the mice in a particular enclosure, they also got zapped. And so in both of these conditions, the mice learned to associate certain stimuli with a bad experience. And then what they did was, about a month later, they took the mice off this drug so that their levels of the enzyme went way up. And at the same time, they repeated these tests where they either played a tone or put them in this enclosure. And then they put the mice back on the drug so that their levels of the enzyme went back to normal. And what they found is that a few weeks later, the mice that had their levels of this enzyme elevated when they were being reminded about the tone all of a sudden forgot about the tone. When the researchers played the tone, the mice didn't remember that the tone was a bad thing. Similarly, the mice that had their levels of this enzyme elevated when they were reminded about the enclosure being a bad thing, all of a sudden they didn't get scared anymore when they were put in this enclosure. So the researchers say this is showing that it's possible to selectively erase certain memories, at least in mice.
So with elevated amounts of the enzyme, mice would forget even previous experiences at getting zapped, whether it be preceded by a tone or being put into this enclosure.
Exactly. It depends on what experience the researchers were reminding them of when they experienced this elevated level of enzyme.
Now, these are genetically modified mice. I imagine this isn't the tactic they're going to be using in people.
Right. These mice were genetically modified, as you say, and you can't do that to humans. But it does show that the memories we form are a lot more malleable than we thought. Some researchers had proposed that the way we form memories is that there's actually anatomical changes that happen in our brain. But this suggests that memories may be more chemical-based. And if that's so, then it means memories are much more subject to manipulation than we previously thought.
Well, speaking of memories, I remember tomatoes as being red or yellow or green. What is this purple tomato, and how is it going to help fight cancer?
Well, Rob, this purple tomato is a newly engineered tomato. And the reason it's purple is because scientists have found a way to make this specific type of tomato express a large amount of a pigment called anthocyanin. And this pigment is what gives the magenta color to, say, raspberries and other fruits. And the reason researchers wanted to add this pigment in the first place to tomatoes is because the pigment has been shown to be a powerful antioxidant. And there's a lot of research out there that shows that antioxidants might be valuable in helping to fight cancer. And tomatoes naturally don't have this antioxidant. So the idea is, if we can give it to tomatoes, and since people eat so many tomatoes, especially all around the world, it's a very common food, then it may be a good way to help fight cancer on a global scale.
Well, how much research is out there about anthocyanin and its benefit to humans? I mean, how many of these superfood tomatoes would you have to eat in order to get a benefit?
Well, obviously, that's the ultimate question is, first of all, do these tomatoes have any benefit? And how many would you have to eat? And what the researchers have so far is some preliminary experiments with mice. The researchers tested three groups of mice, about, 15 or 20 or so mice in each group. And these mice were a little unusual in that they were tumor prone. So they were all predisposed to get cancer anyway. And what they did was they fed some of the mice just a regular diet. Some of them had the dust of freeze-dried red tomatoes added to their diet. And others had the dust of freeze-dried purple tomatoes added to their diet. Now, all of the mice still developed cancer. But what was interesting is that the mice that were on the purple tomato diet took about 40 days longer to die of cancer than the mice that were on the control diet or eating the red tomatoes.
And 40 days is a relatively long time in these lifespans.
Right. Mice don't live that long, so it's actually a big deal.
So how long will it be before we see purple tomatoes in the supermarket?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the research so far is just in mice, and scientists are really going to have to do more tests, especially in humans, to determine whether these purple tomatoes have any benefit for us.
Any concerns about safety? I know there are some countries that are against genetically modified foods.
Right. There is some hesitation about genetically modified foods in some countries. So that's another hurdle any genetically modified food is going to have to overcome.
Okay. Well, from fighting cancer with purple tomatoes to fighting muscular dystrophy using Viagra, how does it help in fighting muscular dystrophy?
Well, to understand that, we have to talk a little bit about what causes muscular dystrophy in the first place. And there's actually several forms of muscular dystrophy. The most common is called Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which affects about 500 boys in the United States every year. And what the disease is it's a gradual weakening of the muscle tissue. And patients with the disease have a very hard time exercising, or when they exercise, they get very fatigued. And over time, their muscles pretty much cease to function. And researchers have been trying to figure out what's going on with this disease at a molecular level. And there was a conference a few years ago when a biophysicist who was working on the disease showed a mouse model of muscular dystrophy, and the mouse looked very lethargic. And somebody in the audience said, hey, that mouse is acting a lot like humans who have a type of muscular dystrophy known as Becker's muscular dystrophy. And what's known about Becker's is that it's caused by the loss of an enzyme called neuronal nitric oxide synthase. And this is an enzyme that produces nitric oxide.
So we're talking about two different kinds of muscular dystrophy, and Viagra helps with both?
Well, they're both muscular dystrophy, but Becker's is a milder form. And this enzyme that's known to play a role in Becker's is also important for providing blood flow to muscles, which makes sense. If you had a problem with the enzyme, maybe the muscles aren't getting the blood they need, and that's why these patients are as fatigued as they are, especially after exercise. And what researchers know about Viagra is it actually boosts blood flow to various parts of the body.
Various parts?
Well, in mice, what the researchers found was that Viagra actually had a very dramatic effect. These mice that had the symptoms of muscular dystrophy when they were given Viagra, all of a sudden when they exercised the mice weren't nearly as fatigued after exercise as the mice that were not given Viagra.
Exercising all parts of their bodies.
Exactly.
So Viagra is already FDA approved. Is this likely to find its way into a clinic as a therapy?
Well, it's possible, but some researchers caution that we still don't know enough about what's actually going on here. And if we give kids with muscular dystrophy Viagra just to allow them to be less fatigued after exercise, they may start exercising more, which actually might be bad, because if the root problem is that their muscles are becoming weak for some other reason, and all of a sudden these kids are starting to exercise more and putting more strain on their muscle, it could actually make the condition worse. So researchers are saying this is an exciting development, especially, as you said, because the drug is already out there. But until we know more, we really need to move slowly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about an ancient tsunami that rivaled the Indian Ocean tsunami back in 2004. The first ironclad evidence of Antarctic warming. And finally, a muscle protein that helps make memories. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to the February 1st Newsmakers article, part of a section edited by Science's Udijit Bhattacharjee. The article describes the confusion over whether forest ecologist Stephen Running is a winner of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize.
That confusion is because Running is a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, which won the Nobel along with former Vice President Al Gore. In the October 3rd issue, another member of the IPCC, Roger Sedgo, writes in with evidence that he, too, is a Nobel laureate.
Sedgo writes, "I was very disappointed to find out that I, like Stephen Running, am not a Nobel laureate. According to the Dear Colleagues letter I received from Ogunlade Davidson and Bert Metz on behalf of the IPCC, I am indeed a Nobel laureate, albeit perhaps along with many, many others. Additionally, a beautiful Nobel Peace Prize certificate with my name on it now adorns my wall. Although the financial remuneration has not yet arrived, I have enjoyed the celebrity status associated with the honor."
You can read the full letter in the October 3rd issue of Science. Our next letter is an installment in our Life in Science series. This one comes from Paul Weiss and Stephen Stranick at the Pennsylvania State University and the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
In their letter, Weiss and Stranick describe how they set up their scanning tunneling microscope so they could hear whether the scopes were working correctly. They write, "Borrowing a trick from electrophysiology, we sent the tuning current of our microscope into an audio amplifier, and then turned our probe tip height into a tune by applying that signal to a voltage-controlled oscillator."
What you're hearing now is the coarse approach of the scanning tunneling microscope tip to the surface. These diagnostic sounds indicate that the approach is working properly. And now the tip has reached and is maintained in tunneling range.
The authors write, "Every student, postdoc, and visitor in the group became familiar with the songs of his or her microscope. They learned which tune meant which problem, and always rejoiced when they heard the best melody of all, the sound of a happily working microscope."
You can read the full letter and listen for free to some of the other microscope melodies in the online version of Weiss and Stranick's letter. It's in the October 10th issue of Science.
Our final letter is in response to a July 18th research article by Kyung-hee Ko and colleagues, who identified a gene they call sleepless, required for sleep in Drosophila. The researchers note that sleep is an essential process conserved from flies to humans.
In his letter, J. Lee Kavanaugh writes, "This is not quite true. Many piscine species are active continuously without sleep, including species of marine and freshwater fishes in which schooling, or swimming synchronously in polarized groups, is fully developed. By schooling, they greatly reduce the average school member's reception and processing of sensory input. Sleep, like schooling, seems to accommodate non-urgent memory processing, leaving the activity period free for critical waking functions and enabling the brain to operate efficiently at all times."
You can read the full letter and another letter about how birds sleep in the October 24th issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. And that wraps up the October 31st, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.